Slavery is back.
Welcome to a place where private business profit from a captive labour force, yet pennies are spent on medical services to a population in which the Indigenous, the poor and the mentally ill are overrepresented. Where isolation, humiliation and degradation are facts of life. Welcome to prison.
It depends who's telling the story, I suppose. The prisoners would have one view, the people who work in the prison system would have another, and I think it's up to people to decide where the truth is.
Give government propaganda and the media spin doctors the flick. And check out Doin' Time for news, views and tunes on prison issues from Guantanamo Bay to Christmas Island to prisons and detention centres everywhere. Every Monday at 4 p.m. on your community radio 3CR.
We are still fired up and we're still talking about revolution.
Hello and welcome to the Doin' Time Show. This is 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial, streaming live on www.3cr.org.au. And a warning that this episode of Doin' Time contains audio images of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have died and graphic discussion of deaths in custody. This is Marissa and I'll be with you for the next hour. Today on the show, we will first be joined by Samantha Lee, Assistant Principal Solicitor at Redfern Legal Centre, about New South Wales Police's response to the Palestine Action Group rally in Sydney, calling for an independent review of New South Wales Police conduct. Redfern Legal Centre calls on the Commissioner of the New South Wales Police Force, Mel Lanyon, to stand down officers whose use of force at that protest appears excessive, based on the available footage. After that, we'll bring you an interview with David Murray, Strategic Projects Lead from Jesuit Social Services, about the expansion of Malmesbury Youth Justice Centre, which is a significant investment at the wrong end of the system, using money that would be far better spent on evidence-based solutions that prevent crime from occurring. Then we will hear from Katie Kiss, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, to discuss a new bill to establish a National Commission for First Peoples Children, which is welcomed by top human rights activist. Katie is a proud Kunjul and Bidiwidi woman who grew up in Rockhampton, central Queensland, on the lands of the Darimbal people. And I am very pleased now to welcome Samantha to the show. Hello, Samantha. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Marissa. How are you?
Good, thank you. And how are you going? You're busy as usual with all this stuff going
Always
on?
Always something going on, Marissa.
Oh, my God.
Never dull.
Never dull. And basically, Redfern is calling on the Commissioner of the New South Wales Police Force to stand down officers. Can you elaborate on that and talk about what's been going on?
Yeah, in New South Wales a couple of weeks ago, there was a protest held by the Palestinian Action Group. Now, there's a lot of complicated legal layers that come into play with this protest because there were a major event declaration and there was also a declaration that protests could not be approved by police. So that did give police additional powers to their existing powers. And the protesters legally were not allowed in the area that they were. However, there is quite a lot of footage that has come out of the protest that shows police not passing the pub tests and probably not going to pass the excessive force test in regards to being taken to the court. So we're seeking for those officers that the video shows them pretty much using excessive force to be stood down until the independent police watchdog, the LEC, investigates the protest and policing.
So the investigation is going to examine allegations of misconduct. And is this about police investigating police at the moment?
Well, the independent watchdog, police watchdog, is independent from police, and they also have extra powers. They can subpoena records, subpoena people to give evidence, have investigative powers. So we're glad it is with the LEC. However, the LEC also has limited powers. They can only make recommendations, and those recommendations are not binding. However, one of the recommendations they can make is for a police officer to be referred for prosecution for a criminal offence. So that's something that the LEC can do.
So this protest, is it actually one protest or several that are being investigated?
It's just this one protest that happened at Town Hall in Sydney.
Oh, okay. Is that the one where the president came to visit?
That's right. When the Israeli president came to Sydney, the CBD, a lot of the CBD of Sydney was declared as part of a major event area. And what that meant is that those areas within the central business district, people were not allowed to enter. And if they did enter, police had powers to search them without reasonable suspicion, to move them on, to use reasonable force to move them on. The big question, though, is whether the force was reasonable. And the footage that's come through, just prima facie, the force does look excessive.
Tell us a bit about the footage. Do you feel comfortable talking about that?
Sure. I mean, there's probably two major pieces of footage that have concerned the public. One is a man is in the protest, initially kind of standing still in front of some officers. One officer is on a mountain bike, and the bike is in between himself and the man. He's called the man in the white shirt. The man in the white shirt puts his hand out to sort of stop. We're not really sure what he's stopping, but it wasn't his hand out in an aggressive way. And then he puts his hands up because he feels like police may think he was trying to do something. The police officer then kind of stumbles over his bike, falls over, and other police then come in and start punching the man in the white shirt a considerable number of times, and it started to get very ugly. Another footage shows a young man who we found out is around 16 years of age on the ground on his stomach with his hands behind his back, and the officers again using a lot of force against him. It is alleged that this person on the ground was biting the finger of a police officer, but appears to be while he's on the ground and being hit at. Mm.
It's very interesting, and you know, I wonder, and look, I wasn't there, and I don't want to comment too much, but perhaps we need to see why is it that the police responded this way, or has there been some action that was initiated by police?
Yeah, it's a good question, Marissa. I mean, we've had concerns about police using excessive force for a while now, and I really don't think it's been reeled in much by previous police commissioners and this current police commissioner. For police, it's not a given power for police to use force. They're only allowed to use force if necessary, and it has to be proportionate and appropriate in the circumstances. So, for example, if I police told me to move on, and I questioned the police and asked him why, for example, and then the police leg swept me, that force would be disproportionate, not appropriate, and excessive. But these types of uses of force are not being called out, and I think bad behaviour is being passed down from one police officer to the next. And what we see is that now police officers are using excessive force, even when people have mobile phones on and they have body-worn video footage. And to me, this says that, one, they're not turning their mind to the legal thresholds of excessive force, and they simply don't seem to care, which is a real big concern.
It really is really looking at, and I know this is in some ways scope for another interview, but I think it's interconnected. You know, it really is a violation of the right to protest, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's an interesting legal mix, because legally the right to protest isn't outlawed. So you can protest, but what these laws said is that you can't protest in a certain area. And if you do, then police have extra powers, and you can be committing an offence. So in this case, the protesters were given by police an alternate route, which would have been legal. However, the protesters didn't want to accept that, and they still went to the town hall, which was a restricted area.
Exactly, but at the same time, it wasn't... The investigation is saying it wasn't necessary to have that excessive use of force.
Well, they haven't investigated yet.
No, not yet.
They're going to go through a process.
Sure.
But I think on the face of it, it doesn't meet the pub test. The footage is from some of the interactions with police is quite disturbing. I'd say just on the face of it, some of these actions would be found to be excessive.
And in particular, to maintain public confidence in police while the facts are being investigated, don't you think these officers whose use of force appears excessive should be stood down, or at the very least removed from frontline duties?
I do, because I think what's come out in the footage is some of their actions were quite dangerous. Force not only causes physical harm, but also mental harm to those who are the recipient of it. No doubt police are under, you know, it would have been intimidating, obviously, in a large crowd, this intense situation. However, they are police officers. They are the ones who are have authority to arrest someone who's not obeying the law. If they are those people who have the power, then they must also follow the law themselves, and they must be, restrained. De-escalate is the policy within police, and they just can't do, just because they feel intimidated, go out and punch someone several times. We need from our police force lawfulness, restraint, ethical behaviour.
Absolutely, Sam, it's always difficult to speak about these things when there's an investigation, you know, happening, isn't it? But it's quite safe to say that excessive force was used, given that there's footage. And I mean, it's disgraceful conduct, and you know, the police force needs to be accountable.
Yes, it does. I mean, I keep saying continuously that the police force is a government body. It receives government funding. It is a government structure, and therefore, like any government agency, it must be transparent, accountable for its actions, no different to any other government department, and we should expect nothing less.
In the history of colonisation, for too long, police have been investigating police, and any independent body often has limited powers. Let's hope that we keep an eye on this.
Yes, thank you, Marissa. There is huge problems with police investigating police, and the police watchdogs are underfunded, under-resourced, so this does create huge issues around justice.
It's so lovely to hear from you, Samantha.
Thanks, Marissa.
Keep up the good work. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye. And that was Samantha Lee, Assistant Principal Solicitor at Redfern Legal Centre, speaking about New South Wales Police's response to the Palestine Action Group rally in Sydney. And, yeah, it's the mind boggles, really.
Are you a current 3CR subscriber? Your membership helps us stay true to our community values.
It enables us to produce over 100 local shows each week, train and support new volunteers and broadcasters, and maintain our transmission technology.
Your subscription helps us cover issues important to you, like public housing, First Nations justice, community languages,
advocacy for Palestine, celebrating queer and trans communities, and bringing you the best of local independent music.
As we head into our 50th year of broadcasting, your ongoing subscription is as vital to the station today as it was for those subscribing in 1976.
Help to keep 3CR unique by becoming a subscriber today.
Go to 3cr.org.au or call 03 9419 8377.
You're listening to the Do and Time Show, 3CR Community Radio, and this is Marissa taking you through until 5 o'clock. More beds at Malmesbury, a sign of failure, not success. And we're going to be interviewing now David Murray. And David has been working in the field for at least 40 years, quite impressive. And David is a strategic project lead. And we're going to be interviewing him from Jesuit Social Services. And I'm delighted to welcome him to the program. Hello, David. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Great to have you. Now, David, I think this is the first time you've been interviewed here, haven't you? On the show?
I think so, yes. Probably is.
Yeah, right. Because the Do and Time show is historically a place where marginalised communities are heard, and we create a safe space for that. So can you just start off by telling us a little bit about what's been going on with this expansion?
Well, as you know, the Nazi was shut down, I think, 3 years ago. Was it 3 years? Something like that.
Yep.
On the basis of the development of the new facility at Cherry Creek, I guess. They've decided to reopen it because, of course, with the change, the proposed changes or the existing changes in the bail laws, there's now increased numbers of people being put in custody, and they've opened it up because they think they need to. And so it's still unclear as to exactly how it's going to operate, but it's essentially 45 new beds, which brings it up to about 75, I think.
Wow. So, yeah, there have been quite horrific bail reforms, haven't there, recently?
Yeah, well, you know, it's been a bit of a saga, hasn't it? I mean, the bail laws were, you know... They've basically become a political football between... it's become very, very politicised and weaponised, so that government has sort of responded to sort of a very volatile public discussion about what to do about youth crime. And sadly, what they've done is they've put their faith in creating an environment where we're going to see more people in custody, but not necessarily produce a better outcome in terms of reform or rehabilitation of people. I mean, we know that putting people in custody, particularly having high numbers on remand where people aren't convicted yet, we know that that is a pretty blunt instrument in terms of dealing with crime. I mean, we have long advocated for a more, what you might describe as progressive response, getting in earlier, dealing with people in the community, working within local communities and families and local community agencies and so on as a better approach. But sadly, not just this jurisdiction, but across the country, the government seems to be investing and putting faith in old and outdated and failed strategies like locking people up.
I mean, there's a 40% increase, isn't there, in the number of young people on remand, isn't there?
That's what it appears to be, yeah. And if you look across the country, that's happening not just in Victoria, but across the, all jurisdictions are doing the same thing. And the thing is that I think people don't appreciate is that that's just going to create, in the long term, more people who get engaged in the criminal justice system, and they're very... Many of them find it hard to extract themselves from that system once they're in it. And so it's actually, rather than sort of reducing the number of people involved and protecting the community, which is what the banner is, community safety, chances are it's doing the opposite.
Absolutely. I mean, there's money being spent to, you know, to have all these beds, but what about money that can go to community programs?
Well, there is some money coming into community programs, but by nowhere near enough, or nowhere near as much as has been placed in sort of building the prison beds. So I think what we're still wanting to say, and we're encouraging the government to, you know, particularly in the next budget, to honour the commitments that were laid out, or rather, not so much the commitments, but the you know, you recall that the youth justice legislation that was put forward to Parliament a bit over a year ago had all sorts of provisions for diversionary strategies, early intervention and so on. And so there have been small amounts of money coming into that, but essentially not enough. And the very vast bulk of investment resources has gone into building prison beds. So I think the jury's still out a bit, but it's not looking good. But we still call on the government to do more in that diversionary early intervention space.
Your CEO, Julie Edwards, from Jesuit Social Services, puts it beautifully, actually, because I'm just having a look at this media release, and, you know, she says that expanding the state's prison capacity is not something to be celebrated. It's evidence of systemic policy failures and of misplaced priorities. Can you comment on that?
Well, she does have a way with words. We understand that.
But it's true, though.
Well, yes, it is. It is. Well, I think
it's public knowledge.
It's long since been saying these answers that are popularly put forward, and, you know, let's face it, we're getting the pressure on government from particularly populist media like the Murdoch Press and social media, you know, sort of banging on about, you know, community safety is the only way to deal with it is to put more people in prison, when the evidence is to the contrary. The evidence is that only just as likely increases the risk of reoffending, but it doesn't actually address the particular circumstances that in particular children and young people are facing. And that's where we've long since said that's where the energy and resources should go.
Absolutely. And there's no harm in saying that, David. It is an absolute atrocity, particularly because we have our First Nations youth as well being overrepresented in prison.
Well, particularly, that's true. And if you look across, again, in other jurisdictions beyond Victoria, it is a national disgrace. There's no doubt that the significant number and proportion of Aboriginal children and young people in custody is just disgraceful. And I mean, in Victoria, we have a smaller number, admittedly, but they're still overrepresented, and they still shouldn't be there. But if you look at nationally, it's absolutely disgraceful.
I mean, from what I can see here, Jesuit Social Services is a social change organisation working to build a just society where all people can fulfil their potential. I mean, how can people fulfil their potential when they're going back to prison and reoffending?
Well, yes, I mean, that's of course, and that's why we're advocating for less reliance on that strategy. But what we're doing in our own right, if you like, is that we're trying to push forward with some initiatives that do, I think, address some of those questions. So we're particularly focused on restorative justice and restorative practice as a way of dealing with some of the young people's circumstances on their behaviours. Also, we have created a school called the Ignatius Learning Centre, which is specifically targeted at that 15 to 17-year-olds who are on you know, youth justice orders. So we're trying to, and we provide the youth justice community support service. So young people in the youth justice system who are on orders on bail and on the new sort of version of enhanced bail, we provide the support services around those young people. So I guess as an organisation, we're heavily engaged, if you like, in specifically targeting and working with those young people in order to keep them out of custody. And that's kind of why we know, over the nearly 50 years of been doing it, we hear the stories of young people who get themselves enmeshed in this sort of criminal justice system. And we kind of know that things that are driving them into this, into the criminal sort of world, and then B, we sort of know the things that they're telling us they need to get out of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Is there anything else that you'd like to comment on before we finish?
Yes, I think you know, I've mentioned a few times looking across other jurisdictions beyond Victoria. I think the big picture issue, as I see it, is that we need a federal government kind of response to this, not just leaving it to each state jurisdiction, because they're getting it badly wrong. And so far, we don't hear much from the government. And I think, you know, last year the outgoing Children's Commissioner from the Human Rights Commission produced this very good report on, which scanned really across youth justice systems across Australia and made a number of quite significant recommendations about there needs to be a minister for children and young people, there needs to be a national approach to youth justice. It needs to be elevated way beyond where it is at the moment because each jurisdiction is getting it badly wrong. So I think that's really where we need to be putting our energy, is sort of getting a response from the federal government and looking at it as a national issue, not just one that is contained to each jurisdiction.
Absolutely, and there also needs to be, you know, that those recommendations need to be implemented. Where can listeners find that report?
On the Human Rights Commission, that's where it is. Off the top of my head, I can't tell you the title of the report now.
That's okay.
The Human Rights Commission, yep. A Children's Commissioner, and you'll find that report. Perhaps we could look it up.
Sure. Just Google it. Now, David, if any young people are listening here, particularly ones that have exited prison, what would you say to them as someone from Jesuit Social Services?
Oh, that's a big question. I think, you know, if you're in trouble and you've been in trouble, I think what we know about the supports that people need is if you've got an adult in your life that you trust, then that's the first port of call in terms of getting support. If you don't have that kind of support, then you need to find a local sort of community service agency that you can get support from. But it's a big question. Usually people who go into youth justice or have been on some sort of order, they generally get linked to a service. So I think most young people will know what the services are.
Sure.
They should contact their local service.
Oh, well, we don't know that. I mean, you know, it could be that you've got youth with disability that are quite isolated. You know, you never know what can happen. But thank you so much for talking about that and for coming onto the program, David. It's been great to have you.
Thanks a lot. No worries.
Thanks. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And that was David Murray from Jesuit Social Services. And Jesuit Social Services urges the Victorian government to focus on the evidence of what works instead of continuing to spend on a costly and ineffective prison system. So it was lovely to talk to David. Razor, don't you watch my size? I'm
dangerous. I'm dangerous. Come join us for Step and Razor, Saturday 28th of February from 4 p.m. till late at Hard Out in Preston, raising funds for Flat Out Inc., community in West Papua, and for costs associated with immigration legal fees for our comrades. Vinyl will be spinning from 4 p.m. with selections from Goodies Hi-Fi, Lego, Martha, Counter Attack, Good Behaviour, James Codeine, Hayley Stoneham and Dave Slater. There'll be a raffle with prizes including vouchers from your favourite local venues, original artwork, jewellery, record packs, leather goods and more. Step and Razor, Saturday 28th of February from 4 p.m. at Hard Out Bar, 670 Plenty Road in Preston on the 86 tram line. Hard Out is a 3CR supporter.
Carmen knows it bluntly. You don't go through 1/5 of the tribulation with either.
Anarchism 2026 is a public one-day conference hosted by the Anarchist Communist Federation coming up on March 7 at Ballumballum Place. Join us for a day of talks, panels and discussions exploring anarchist ideas, working class history and today's political landscape, as well as real organising lessons from on the ground. Tune in for such great sessions. We're talking fascism and anti-fascism, oppression and class liberation, rank and file interventions in our unions, the struggle for Palestine, BLF, green bans and the climate crisis, and that perennial favourite, Marxism and anarchism. Are they in fact in opposition, or might we argue something else? So if you're interested in a one-day conference on anarchism, check out Anarchism 2026, Saturday the 7th of March at Ballumballum Place in Brunswick. Tickets are available at ancomfed.org, that is ancomfed.org. The Anarchist Communist Federation is a 3CR supporter. 'Cause baby, I'm an anarchist.
And you're listening to the Do and Time Show, 3CR Community Radio, and it's Marissa. Australia's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner and National Children's Commissioner have welcomed the introduction of legislation to establish the National Commission for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Young People as a permanent statutory agency. The commission was initiated 2 years ago to help meet the Australian government's commitments under the National Agreement on Closing the Gap and has been operating under the auspice of the Department of Social Services. As I explained in my intro, Katie Kiss, a proud Kanju and Biddy-Witty woman, leads a social justice commissioner advocating for First Nations rights and truth-telling in Australia. And I'll have Katie talk about her land, as I might have mispronounced. Katie grew up in Rockhampton, central Queensland, on the lands of the Dirrumbal people. So I wanted to actually yarn with Katie about all this and talk to her about how she feels about everything. She spent 8 years at the Australian Human Rights Commission as director of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Team before she had this role. And she says that now more than ever, we need policies which promote reconciliation and unity, not division and discord. And I'm delighted to welcome her to have a yarn. Hi, Katie.
Hey, Marissa. How you going?
Good. I'm all right. Considering what's been happening, it's a tough year, isn't it?
Oh, it's been pretty full on, hey?
Oh, my goodness. So can you tell us, as a commissioner and, you know, also as First Nations, what's going on?
Oh, there's a lot of stuff going on around the country, Marissa. You know, obviously I want to acknowledge country first.
Of course.
And the land from where we come from. As you said, I'm a proud Kanju Biddy-Witty woman. So my country is up in Cape York in North Queensland, but I did grow up, born and bred on the lands of the Dirrumbal people in Rockhampton. So a proud Aboriginal woman. I'm really concerned about the circumstances that we're seeing play out in our communities at the moment. And there's a whole range of things that are going on, right? So I want to acknowledge the Invasion Day rally in Perth, where we saw an alleged device thrown into our community gathering over there. And that now is going through a court proceeding. But the fear that that's raised in our communities and born from racism that we've been exposed to over generations. So we're seeing this escalate on the back of the referendum in particular, the racism that's coming from the back of the Bondi attack. These sorts of attacks are escalating. We saw the Camp Sovereignty situation play out as well. So racism in our community is going through the roof. It's also being reflected in policies across the country that are affecting in particular Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. And I come from Queensland, and so we are the first state to introduce adult crime, adult time legislation, which is having a massive impact on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. We know that our children, through the Closing the Gap targets, are being still removed from their families at unprecedented and inappropriate rates. So there's so much going on for our people and our children and our families at the moment, and we're dealing with so much. And I think, you know, we need to be working together a bit more closely to try to resolve some of that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And I believe there's a new bill that's being looked at the moment.
There is. So as you mentioned in your introductory remarks, the National Commission for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Young People's Bill 2026 was introduced to the Australian Parliament in early February. And that bill sets up the statutory appointment and the office of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Young People's Commissioner. That was that position has been fought for a long time by our peak organisations like SNAIC, but also our State and Territory Children's Commissioners, and that includes our First Peoples Children's Commissioners in states and territories. And obviously the Human Rights Commission backed that call as well with our National Children's Commissioner at the Human Rights Commission and my position as well, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner. So, you know, this will be the first time we've had, and the Commissioner's already sitting in that position with Sue-Ann Hunter doing a great job and Lil Gordon setting that position up initially, but this will be the first time that we have a statutory body that deals specifically with issues that are affecting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, including from child removal to youth detention, but also more positive initiatives like access to healthcare, access to education, making sure that people have got cultural foundations grounded and children are developmentally accessing their culture to take a positive approach forward in their futures. So this commissioner role is very important. You'll hear some conversation about the fact that it aligns very closely to both my position and the National Children's Commissioner, and we've designed it to make sure that it's operating consistently with the principles that the Australian Human Rights Commission are based on, and that includes human rights principles. So it's been designed like that on purpose, not to double up or duplicate, but to make sure that we're all working towards the same outcomes.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because that really needed to be looked at. And this role is the only one at the national level, isn't it?
We have a National Children's Commissioner who's Deb Sabaris. She's my colleague at the Australian Human Rights Commission. But there's no requirement for that position to be an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person. So under this legislation, this commissioner is required to be of Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander background. So not even my position as the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner is required to be held by one of our mob.
Wow. It's so important to have First Nations led, isn't it?
Absolutely it is. And, you know, we've seen the work that Lil's done to take this legislation forward, but also being carried now by Sue-Ann Hunter, who, you know, played a big role in child safety. She's had a big role in women and children's issues, but she's also played a massive role in the Yarrup Justice Commission, the Truth-Telling Commission in Victoria, and she heard the issues from the Victorian state level, at least, around children's issues and the statistics that we're seeing in those closing the gap outcomes that we keep failing. So, you know, this position is going to be critical in the broader infrastructure to closing the gap, but also into making sure that we are realising the rights of children, that children's voices can be escalated, our children's voices can be escalated. You know, in Queensland, we have 10-year-olds sitting in watch houses for up to 3 weeks at a time. We need to address those systemic and structural discriminatory issues that are impacting our families and our children, and Sue-Ann will have a significant role in that.
This show that we run here at 3CR, we look a lot at all this stuff. In particular, we look at Stolen Generation. And one of the things that is a real atrocity is that First Nation kids are being left behind and they're overrepresented in the child protection and youth detention systems. And I find that to be disgraceful conduct by government.
Absolutely. You know, we're seeing governments, state and territory governments, commit to targets under closing the gap to reduce things like youth detention, to reduce out-of-home care and the removal of children from their families and communities, and to make sure that they stay connected to community and culture. But we're seeing state and territory jurisdictions progress legislation that is in direct contradiction to those targets and those commitments that they have signed up to. You know, the thing that concerns myself and my fellow commissioners at the national level is that there is not a lot of national leadership to hold those states and territories accountable to those standards that we have committed to, not just under closing the gap, but in international human rights law. So, for example, the age of criminal responsibility at the international level is 14. We have 10-year-olds in some jurisdictions being put into watch houses, adult watch houses. So we are not in compliance with our international obligations, we're not in compliance with the rights of children, and we're not in compliance with the standards that we want to see as Australians in the way that we treat all children, but in particular Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children.
And when will this bill be implemented, do you think?
So it was introduced in early February. They've had the debate in the House of Representatives and it's gone to the Senate, is my understanding. So they'll have some conversations in the Senate. They'll work out whether they support it in the Senate or not, and it'll come back down to the House of Representatives to be voted on and then enacted, hopefully. We know that the LNP government have already made their position public around the fact that they won't be supporting this bill, which is disappointing. And both Commissioner Hunter and I sat in on the debate in the House of Representatives when this bill was debated. Some of the commentary that came out of opposition members to the bill was pretty alarming and reminiscent of policies of past practice, which is significantly concerning. Because as you mentioned, you know, we've had those policies that impacted the stolen generation, that created the stolen generation. We've had a national apology that says we will never do that again. But the policies and practices that we're seeing coming out are absolutely doing that again. And then we have this position, which is about undoing some of that harm and damage that's been done through those policies and practices. And we've got the opposition government saying, no, we're not going to support that. So I'm really concerned about where we're heading. I'm really concerned about the impact of these policies and processes on our kids. And I'm really concerned about the fact that we're setting our communities up to fail. The Prime Minister has made a statement in, you know, Close the Gap Week to say that we don't want to keep talking about failure. Well, in order for us to stop talking about failure, we need to stop failing.
Yeah, so they need to put in the new bill to you know, establish you know, good things for First Nations children.
Yeah, positive progress. And so, you know, props to the Labor government for doing this, the Albanese government. They have introduced this bill through Minister Plibersek. She's taken an active role in this and she's a champion for this legislation. So it's a really positive movement in terms of the Labor government's commitment to closing the gap. This is a positive, tangible outcome to make sure that we've got a commissioner in place that can help facilitate the voices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and young people on issues that affect them. And that's critical to the implementation of, for example, the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and Self-Determination. So it's really critical that government supports this. It's a positive bill. If it's enacted, we hopefully will see some change. And Commissioner Hunter, myself, Commissioner Sabaris, the National Children's Commissioner, and even people like Michaela Cronin, who's the Domestic and Family Violence Commissioner, we've all committed to work closely together to make sure that we have a spotlight on children's rights and that we're trying to set foundations that make sure that our kids are moving in the right direction.
You were saying at the beginning of this conversation that, you know, all this stuff's been going on with racism and camp sovereignty and what's happened in Perth. Let's hope that none of this bill isn't impacted by racism or racist
undertones. Well, you know, I think whenever there's a conversation about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's rights, we get the opposition saying that, you know, they're getting more than everybody else. We had a treaty conversation on the weekend where, you know, we talked about the impact of native title debate where Australians were led to believe that we're coming for their backyards, you know. So after the referendum, you know, The Voice, anything to do with Aboriginal affairs, we voted against that. Well, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have specific human rights. We have unique rights that are related to our culture and to our access to who we are as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And so we need to be progressing those things. We also have a national anti-racism framework that was commissioned by the federal government in order to eradicate racism. And that's one of the priority reforms under the National Closing the Gap Agreement, to eradicate racism and transform the way government works with our people. So we've got some key targets. We've got some key tools to address some of those things. We now need to enact them and put them into action. And so I've been having conversations with government about picking that national anti-racism framework up. And my colleague, Giri Sivaraman, who's the Race Discrimination Commissioner, he's also been out there banging the drum, trying to get, action on that anti-racism approach. So there's a lot of work we need to do in the Australian community, and the Prime Minister's acknowledged that during the Closing the Gap Week, but also in response to the Borloo Perth attack. So, you know, we're now in a process where we have to be careful about how we progress that. We've got a court case underway, but we need to be addressing racism in our country in a very specific, targeted and strategic approach that takes into account our rights, but also that national anti-racism framework to eradicate racism in our community more broadly.
Absolutely. I mean, look, we need to really understand, I suppose, that this is still a colony and there's been so much suffering of First Nations people on the missions, and it's really important, isn't it, to look back over history, and that these things are also happening now. So it's really amazing that this new bill will hopefully be established.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we are seeing positive movement from the government's perspective around things like this bill that's going in to protect the rights of our children, but also things like the Yarrup Justice Commission and the truth-telling work that's been undertaken there. You know, we started a process in Queensland. We had a Path to Treaty Act that got repealed by the Queensland LNP government. But we've done a lot of work to support truth-telling across the country now. We're starting to build momentum back around that after the referendum. And, you know, we're all still committed to those three pillars of voice, treaty and truth. You know, Aboriginal people can't, and Torres Strait Islander people can't make decisions without having a voice structure to participate in those decisions. We can't end up with agreements that have positive outcomes for our people, like treaties, if the broader Australian community don't understand the history of the country that we live in and the impact that's been had on the lives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people through government policy. And most Australians don't actually know that history, and that came out through the preparation that we did for The Voice. But there's a lot more work to do around civics education and making sure that Australians, more broadly, understand the origins of the country that they live in, the history of the country that they live in, and our collective history going forward now, and how we move together, unified, as a nation that respects each other.
And you're listening to the Do and Time show. It's approximately 4:46. So what else would you like to say before we actually finish?
I think the other thing, Marissa, that I just wanted to touch on is that the Australian government adopted the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in 2009. So we're now 16 years since the Australian government made that commitment. That is a blueprint that underpins those targets that are in Closing the Gap. Now, if we didn't have human rights issues in Australia, there'd be no need for Closing the Gap. And I'm now on the second iteration of that since working in the Human Rights Commission. But each of those targets represents a human rights breach.
Yeah.
The remedy to that is the implementation of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, because it provides a blueprint for addressing every single one of those rights that have been breached under the Closing the Gap Agreement. So the government have had a parliamentary inquiry on that. They have six recommendations sitting on the table. It's been 2 years since that inquiry provided that report, and we've had no response from government. So there are a couple of key items. There's a National Human Rights Act that needs to be implemented. There's the implementation of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and there's the implementation of that national anti-racism framework. And seeing those key pillars in place will put us in good stead to address those Closing the Gap targets that continue to go backwards.
You've just explained things so beautifully, Katie. And I'm just, you know, I love it. I mean, I love the way you talk about, you know, the laws and the legislation, because I think there simply isn't enough talk about this, is there?
Well, I don't think the broader Australian community understand this, you know, ecosystem that we exist within, but I also don't think that our people know their rights well enough to be able to advocate for them. You know, we hear a lot of talk about truth and treaty and self-determination and land rights and all that sort of stuff, but what does that look like in the sense of dealing with discrimination, addressing racism, closing the gap and making sure that our rights are realised. So I think, you know, we do have tools available to us. We need to work collectively to make sure that the momentum is there to put pressure on government to implement them now. If the Prime Minister is as committed as he says he is to closing the gap, well, we've got the tools there. Start working with us to implement them.
We certainly need to also get the First Nations children out of prison as well.
Absolutely. The last thing we need is our kids in jail. And, you know, we're overrepresented in the adult population. I did my listening tour where I visited three prisons in the Northern Territory. And, you know, it's overwhelming, the number of our people that are in those prisons. That's adults. And then, you know, we know that we're significantly overrepresented in the children youth detention facilities as well. But the other thing that I'm mindful of is the rising and constantly increasing numbers of deaths in custody. And, you know, coming out of the Royal Commission into deaths in custody, we've had more than 620 deaths in custody now since that, plus the 99 that were considered as part of that Royal Commission. No one has ever been held criminally responsible for any of those deaths in custody. So there is work to do there too. And, you know, the thing is with our children and our women in particular, two of the fastest growing populations in the prison area, going into these detention facilities, we set them up for a future that is not looking good for our people. So we're heading back to some of the practices of the old days. And if we're committed to closing the gap, then we need to be working in a different way. And that's what the Closing the Gap transformation approach is about.
We certainly need to build the movement to stop Aboriginal deaths in custody and to stop police investigating police. I mean, look what happened to Lex Watton in Queensland.
Yeah, and, you know, Kumanjoe Walker, and we've got now Kumanjoe White's case underway. And so there's a whole lot of people, like I said, 618 that have died in custody since the Royal Commission. So, you know, we've got a lot of work to do in that space. We've been talking to government about some options around dealing with that and making sure that we've got monitoring units in place. Most people wouldn't be aware that under the former Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission, ATSIC, there was a monitoring unit in ATSIC on the Rikidik recommendations. And when ATSIC was dismantled under the Howard government, that unit went with it. Nothing was ever replaced. So, you know, we need monitoring around those recommendations, which most of them have not been addressed, and that goes to the Bringing Them Home report recommendations as well. But we also need, like you're saying, independent investigatory models to make sure that police are not investigating police when there's deaths in custody.
I mean, the recommendations certainly haven't been implemented
for
the Royal Commission.
The Royal Commission or the Bringing Them Home report.
Both.
We talked earlier about stolen gens. Only 6% of those recommendations have been implemented.
Wow.
And Rikidik, I'm not sure of the percentage on that, but I know a large proportion of them haven't been implemented. But also, you know, things like the criminalisation of public drunkenness. That was a recommendation of the Royal Commission, and we're seeing that now being reintroduced in the Northern Territory. The Dondale Review, the Dondale Royal Commission, you know, they banned the use of spit hoods. We're going back to that in the Northern Territory again. So we're regressing from key positive recommendations that we saw starting to hit the ground and make change in the way that these systems operate and affect our people. But then we see governments come in and regress back to those harmful policies and practices that can destroy our people.
Absolutely. And this show, the Doing Time Show, is committed to honouring the dead. We often do roll call in terms of deaths in custody. And I'd like to also honour Auntie Tanya Day, who died as a result of not having those laws.
Yeah, and, you know, I think the other thing to understand is that when we're talking about deaths in custody, we're not just talking about deaths in prison. We're talking about deaths in the back of paddy wagons. We're talking about deaths in watch houses. We're talking about being arrested on the street and dying while you're being held down on the ground. So, you know, deaths in custody has a broader connotation than just dying in a prison cell.
That is a really, really important connection to make, Katie. I've so enjoyed talking to you. Is there anything else?
Oh, I think I've covered a fair bit this afternoon, Marissa.
You
I
have.
Get back to you, to your yarn.
Thank you so much for coming onto the show, Katie, and I hope to hear back from you very soon.
Thank you very much for having me.
Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
And that was Katie Kiss, who is the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, discussing a new bill to establish a national commission for First Peoples children, which is welcomed by top human rights advocates. And she also spoke about Aboriginal deaths in custody, stolen generation, and a host of other things, which were terribly important and interconnected.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In Naam, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
And you're listening to the Do In Time Show, 3CR Community Radio. It's approximately 4:54, and I'll be going out pretty soon with our theme song, Blackfella, Whitefella by the Rumpy Band, and Climate Action Group is up next. But before I actually go, I wanted to thank all of our guests for coming onto the show, and it was just really important to talk about all these things, the new bill and looking at youth. So I'd say that this show is really dedicated to our youth, and not just First Nations youth, but all youth in prison. And there'll be ongoing discussion and more coverage in the coming weeks about this, in particular also about the bail laws, the very tough bail laws that have come through in Victoria and, of course, Queensland. It's been very difficult there as well. So I'll be going out now pretty soon, and stay strong, take care of each other, stay tuned for the Do In Time Show every Monday from 4 to 5, and stay tuned. And sorry that there was no music. There was just too much going on the show. Okay, take care and bye.
White fella. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.